I somewhat run something here called the Center on Children and Families, and we're one of the sponsors of this event. Since 2004, Bell and Alice Rivlin, several others here at Brookings, have been extremely worried about the deficit. And we've done all the kind of stuff, mostly ineffective, that scholars do, write stuff and give speeches. And actually some things we've done, I think, have had some influence. At least we provoked people by recommending that Social Security and Medicare be on a budget and that Congress would have to take action if they didn't meet their budget targets. That produced lots of outcry. So some of the people that participate in the outcry are here today. We also worked with other organizations and participated in a tour of the United States, and I think now been to 60 cities or something like that, giving talks about how serious a deficit is, trying to rile up the grassroots, and meeting with local editorial boards and so forth. So we've done a whole array of things, including things that scholars do not normally do. Roughly speaking, trying to bring attention to how serious the deficit is and the consequences of not dealing with the deficit, and then proposing concrete solutions, which we've been doing since, I think, 2005. We laid out a number of plans for reducing deficit. And now, of course, we have at least 12 fairly comprehensive deficit reduction plans on the table. So that is really a great achievement, and you can tell that the Congress has really paid careful attention to them because they've only spent $1 trillion so far this week. So they're right on board here. Today's event is designed to do two things. First of all, the President's Commission is probably the most important of the commissions because it's the President's, and also because of the people who are on the commission. So we're going to focus especially on that one, but knowing the panelists as I do, they're free to talk about any of the 12 or, in fact, some whatever they want to talk about that is a plan for reducing the deficit. And we're going to focus first on the adequacy of these plans, what is the correct balance between taxes and revenues, what should be off the table, that sort of thing. And then the second panel is going to focus specifically on whether there should be a protection for programs for the poor and for low-income families and for programs that promote opportunity, so education programs and other programs that are intended to promote opportunity. Some of you may recall that back in the days of Graham Redmond Hollings, a strange beast, there actually was a proposal by the Congress that passed, and everyone agreed to it, and the idea was that, roughly speaking, you had to meet budget targets or there were severe penalties that Congress would have to pay. And in that proposal, programs for the poor got almost complete protection, a very substantial protection. So it's not unprecedented, and there's a great concern among people, especially at the Ford Foundation and at Casey, as we'll see in a minute, that these programs might deserve some protection. So that's the second purpose of today's event. The event is sponsored by, in addition to Brookings, Spotlight on Poverty and Opportunity and the Hudson Institute, with support from the Casey Foundation. So we want to thank all the co-sponsors and the people who helped to pay the bill. And the event itself was planned primarily by Mike Larracy of Casey, by Jody Levin-Epstein of CLASS, Sam Gill of the Friedman Consulting, and Amy Batcher of the Hatcher Group. Batcher is spelled with a J, but it rhymes with Hatcher, so you can always remember. You get all these great facts from me. It's free. All right, here's our plan for the day. First of all, I'm going to make brief introductory remarks and introduce the presence of Casey and Ford, who then will speak. Then Bruce Reed, who I'm sure everybody knows, was the executive director of the President's Commission, is going to talk to us for a few minutes about the President's Commission and what it recommended. And then we're going to have a panel of experts and advocates who will reflect primarily on the recommendations of the provision from an adequacy budget perspective with some attention to whether the poor should be protected. And then we'll have a second panel to focus specifically on whether there should be protections, and if so, what should those protections be like. I'm going to moderate the first panel, and my good friend Bill Shambra, who's here somewhere, there he is, will moderate the second panel. And during the course of the event, we'll have lots of opportunity for discussion among the panelists and for questions from the audience. So now I have the privilege of introducing two eminent Americans, the presidents, respectively, of the Annie E. Casey and the Ford Foundation. Many of you probably know that Brookings is famous for brief introductions, and you have biographical material in your folders that tell you about these. And I'm usually happy to continue in the brief introduction tradition of Brookings, but let me point out to you that Patrick McCarthy is not only the head of Casey, but he's my boss because I work at Casey, at least part-time. So I think it behooves me to say something fascinating and generous about Patrick. He's a little nervous right now. What's the guy going to say now? So here's what I decided to say about Patrick. Among his many qualifications and experiences, one of the nation's great thinkers and doers to help protect kids who are abused and neglected, he also has a background as a therapist. This qualification accounts for his ability to so effectively oversee my work and the work of Mike Larisee and the other staff at KC, especially Mike Larisee. So, Patrick, welcome. And then next, Luis Ubinas, who's the president of the Ford Foundation and whom I had the opportunity to meet for the first time this morning. He has a striking background in business and especially technology and communications. Here's my conclusion about his background. Someone who gives away $500 million a year can communicate any way they want to. Patrick.
Well, good morning, everybody, and I think you'll be pleased to know that our primal scream approach to therapy with Ron is just going very, very well. I want to thank Ron for that truly generous introduction. The KC Foundation is very, very pleased and proud to be associated with this event, and really want to thank and acknowledge the leadership and the long partnership with the Ford Foundation that we've had over the years, thanks to Louise and his whole staff, and to Ron and to Bill for moderating the panel. Thanks very much to the Planning Committee, to the whole Brookings staff, and to all the participants here today, because I think we're going to be taking up one of the most serious issues that this country faces. Not only how do we get our handle around the fiscal deficit at the federal, and I would argue also the state level, but how do we do it in a way that's smart, that's intelligent, that actually ends up leaving us in a stronger position. The three sponsors of today's event, the Brookings Budgeting for National Priorities Project, Spotlight on Poverty and Opportunity, and the Hudson Institute's Bradley Center for Philanthropy and Civic Renewal, all three of these organizations share a common theme, and that is they look at issues in a way that expands the conversation, that tries to build a larger tent within which different ideas can come to bear. And in this day where cross-aisle conversations can be not just heated but in many respects nasty, that kind of cross-ideological, bipartisan conversation is exactly what we need and unfortunately very rare. So I think this is a particularly important conversation to have precisely because it is cross-ideological. I want to give a special nod to Spotlight on Poverty and Opportunity. You know, this is the one place where you can find almost everything you want to know about poverty and opportunity, and again, a great partnership between Ford and Casey in sponsoring the Spotlight. So one thing that's become absolutely crystal clear is that this nation has to address the federal budget deficit, even in the long term, even as we continue to pay attention to stimulating the economy in the short term. If we are to delay making some tough choices about the federal deficit, there is no question that we will leave to our children and to our children's children a mess that will hinder our ability to grow, hinder our ability to be successful, and is downright immoral to leave to our children the resolution of problems as complicated as they will inherit if we don't act now. At the same time, it would be also wrong to try to solve the budget deficit at the expense of the most vulnerable, the most low-income and disadvantaged kids and families in the country, those kids and families at that bottom third of the income distribution. We know they're already struggling to just survive and to raise their kids in the toughest economic climate we've seen in a long time. It's not only wrong, though, it's also, from our point of view, foolhardy if we were to try to solve this deficit problem with policies that end up increasing poverty, decreasing opportunity and decreasing the opportunity for mobility. To cut back on smart investments in our children's future would hurt our productivity, our economic growth, our capacity to innovate, our global competitiveness. Now is precisely the right time to maintain smart investments in a two-generation approach to reducing poverty and increasing opportunity. We know that the deficit reduction strategies that we'll have to take up will cause pain for all of us. All of us need to share in the sacrifice. In a way, it's important to say all of us have to have skin in this game. I would argue, however, that the families that are below that 200% of the poverty line, in fact, don't have much skin left to put in the game. In fact, if you think about a family making $250,000 or more a year, if they were to experience a tax increase, that means $10,000 coming out of their pocket. The reality means that they will not be able to get that better sound system for their car, a navigation system, and maybe they'll have to settle for a regular suspension system on their Lexus. But the reality is that if you take $1,000 out of the EITC benefit for a family that makes $25,000 a year, they risk having the utilities turned off and their kids not getting the diet they ought to have. So let me just end by saying thank you for coming this morning to listen, to learn, to share points of view on how we can not just spare the axe, but perhaps take more of a scalpel approach as we think about our poorest population. I would argue that we should reframe the question not to should the disadvantaged be spared the budget axe, but rather what sacrifices would be fair, just, and smart to ask the poor and the near poor to make. Thanks very much.
Good morning, everybody. Let me begin by thanking Brookings for hosting us and by thanking our co-sponsor, Spotlight on Poverty and Opportunity, and the Hudson Institute. I'm also glad to open this event with Patrick, who has been a great partner to the foundation for 15 years, well before taking on leadership of the foundation. Now, the conversation we're going to have today is important to Ford because explicit in our mission is the belief that all people have the opportunity to reach, must have the opportunity to reach their full potential, to contribute to society, and to have a voice in the decisions that affect them. The opportunity, in other words, in making this great country of ours even stronger. In many ways, it's the guidepost of the foundation. And at Ford, we've worked for decades to promote this issue of economic fairness and opportunity, not through handouts and dependence on government, but through work, equitable work, where effort is met with fairness. And three core initiatives right now define our work in this field today, and many of you were involved with us in this work. First, and you should feel this, I hope, in the field, we've vastly expanded our efforts to strengthen programs and policies which allow working families to stay in jobs even when they face personal hardship. Policies such as paid sick leave and family leave, so that when a hard-won job is at risk because a child breaks an arm or an elderly parent falls ill, that person doesn't lose the job. Second, we're investing in efforts, and again, a dramatic increase in our efforts here. We're investing in efforts to help low-income working Americans build assets, build the assets they need to establish financial stability, to establish productive, independent economic lives. Now, let me just say that the federal budget isn't silent on this issue. For those of us who are middle class or affluent, federal mortgage deductions, 401k tax deferrals, and a slew of other asset building assistance is central to our ability to establish financial security. Our work at Ford is focused on building similar incentives such as child savings accounts for low-income families who might not have the resources to buy a home or whose employers don't yet provide a 401k. Last, there are times when even the most hardworking among us can't make ends meet. when even the most hardworking among us are forced to rely on the social safety net. By the way, a social safety net that almost every American family has had a member saved by. This is not an issue of the poor or the Hispanic or the black or the female or the young. Almost every American family has used the safety net. On this issue, we're working with states to make this social insurance, unemployment and food stamps, for example, easier to receive and keep, so that when we do face hardship, we can stay on our feet long enough to fight our way back into the workforce. Let me just pause to say that this struggle to hold on to the vestiges of economic stability long enough to earn a job is the difference between getting back on your feet and falling out of society. Back in the early 80s, and it seems literally like an eternity ago to me, I was a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and I covered homelessness in San Diego. I spent night after night with people who'd fallen through that social safety net. And what struck me wasn't how destitute those homeless men, women, and children were. As poor as they were, that wasn't what struck me. What struck me was how desperate they were to get back into the working mainstream. They'd fallen through the safety net and just couldn't get back up. One of the many things that makes America great is our shared belief, a shared sense that there's a level below which we will simply not let our brothers and sisters, our neighbors and friends fall, a common belief in the proverb, "There but for the grace of God go I." So as we discuss the fiscal crisis we're in, and many of you are engaged in this conversation every day, as we participate in that discourse, we need to remember that as Americans, we have a dual responsibility. We need to ensure that we not leave our children, my children, and your children with a legacy of debt, just as Patrick just said. But we also need to ensure that our basic American values of fairness and equity are upheld. We need to ensure that the neediest among us do not bear the brunt of our past fiscal irresponsibility. So I hope over the course of today, I hope that in this context, you'll listen to the people who are here today. They represent a broad range of views, and that's a good thing. We need all views represented. But in the end, we have to remember that no matter how we think about the future, no matter how we think about the legacy of debt we leave to our children, we cannot solve that problem. We cannot solve that problem by violating the basic American value that all of us deserve an opportunity to participate in the economic well-being and the prosperity and in the goodness of this country. Thanks.
So now it's time. We have the great good fortune of introducing Bruce Reed, a longtime friend and adversary. Bruce and I had a number of secret meetings back in the old days when we were doing welfare reform, and he represented the Clinton administration, and I was with the Ways and Means Committee. And I quickly grew to respect him greatly, and as far as I can tell, he hasn't changed a bit over the years. Totally reliable. Completely unlike most people in Washington, you can count on everything he says, and I have yet to hear him exaggerate. So, Bruce, the microphone's yours. Don't exaggerate.
Thanks, Ron. You've changed a lot since I knew you. I knew Ron when he was a conservative. I want to thank you for putting on this forum. It puts the issue of equal opportunity front and center in this debate, as it should be in every debate we have. And a special thank you to Patrick and Louise for what they said. And to Brookings for all the help that they gave the President's Commission in laying the groundwork for what we did. Ron and Bell Sawhill and a number of other people met regularly many months, providing all kinds of advice. And then it was all hands on deck for Brookings generally. Alice Rivlin was on the commission. Actually, she was on two commissions. And a number of people at Brookings gave us all kinds of support. Before I address the specific question on the table this morning, I want to say a few words about the overall plan that that our commission put forward and some of the lessons that it might offer for where we go with the opportunity debate and others. The first thing that is quite apparent to me is that the American people are more than ready for this debate. They're way ahead of Washington on this. Most commissions spend their time running around the country trying to get people exercised about a problem. We never left town because we realized that the real problem was here. The country's ready to act. It's not clear whether Washington is ready to act. And the reason for that, in part, is that Americans have spent the last 2 years sitting around their kitchen table running their own little debt commissions trying to decide what they could what they could learn to live without, what kinds of long-term hard choices they had to make. And they want Washington to do the same. They want them they're not quite sure about the magnitude of those choices, and they have very little confidence that Washington will get it right, but they want that debate to happen. The second very heartening lesson is that it's not impossible to bridge the partisan divides in Washington. You know, in many ways, this town is broken, but it is possible if you go and listen to both sides and try to take the best ideas from both, people can find common ground. We were essentially a search party for divided government, and we found a lot more than we expected to, and I think that's an encouraging sign given the challenges that our country faces. And the exercise of the commission was to spend 6 months together with equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats and stare at the same cold, hard facts, and people came away with it reaching strikingly similar conclusions about the urgency of the problem and about many of the things that we need to do to solve it. For members of Congress, that was in many ways a unique experience. They don't get that many chances to speak honestly to one another across party lines. And I think many of them were shocked to discover just how much the status quo needs to be changed in a number of areas that hadn't been on the table before. We had a number of sessions that were kind of true confessions for people when Democrats complained about duplication of programs. Republicans acknowledged that there are many parts of the defense budget that haven't been scrutinized in many, many years. And everybody's jaw dropped when conservative defense analysts came in front of us and said that the Defense Department wasn't really sure how many contractors it had on its payroll. It was somewhere between 1 million and 9 million. I think everybody on both sides of the aisle was horrified by the current state of the tax code. We spent a lot of time talking about spending in the tax code, about tax expenditures, and about how there's $1.1 trillion in tax expenditures on an annual basis on the individual side, and the government only brings in $1 trillion a year in personal income taxes. So there are more loopholes than money coming in. There's more holes than cheese. I think that that got under the skin of both Democrats and Republicans alike, because both sides have things they'd rather do with that kind of money. The third, I think, encouraging lesson is that the more serious the problems we face, easier it is for real leaders to get serious. And what we're up against is deadly serious. As Ron and Bell and others have pointed out on numerous occasions, we're looking at an increase of in the debt of about $7 trillion over the next 9 years, going to take us all the way up to $20 trillion by 2020. By 2020, we'll be in a position where we, if we don't change our ways, we will owe $1 trillion a year in interest alone, most of that going to our competitors. So it's not a matter of whether we face up to this. We're going to have to. It's just a question of whether we get ahead of it or we don't. As Ron said, it may take a while for the things to change here in Washington. A couple weeks ago, we declared that the era of deficit denial was over. Well, it may be over, but Washington wants to have a big year-end closeout sale before it leaves. We shouldn't underestimate the magnitude of the challenges that we face here. We're we have to do a lot of things that we have not been able to do in the past. We have to find a way to bend curves that we're not quite certain how to bend, healthcare costs, other curves that we've never taken on before, like Social Security, and then we have to find our way around curves that can't bend. We're growing older as a society. We are in the economic fight of our fight of our lives. So we're trying to fight many fronts at once. To the point that we're talking about this morning, we have to ask Americans to make sacrifices to avert the next crisis at the same time that they're still reeling from the last one. And that's especially true for the poor and the near poor. Life for them was tough before the Great Recession. It's much tougher now. So that's going to take more courage and more wisdom than the political system is used to. On the other hand, I think it is a it's a very important debate for a nation to have. I mean, it's so much of what we do is on autopilot. So it's so rare that we have a chance as a country to go back to first principles and decide, is everything we're doing the smartest way to do it? And I think we were thrilled by the degree of bipartisan interest in having that conversation and by the guts that that senators like Dick Durbin and Kent Conrad and Tom Coburn and Mike Crapo showed in kind of standing up to the conventional wisdom and the forces on each side of the aisle. Let me say a little bit about this particular challenge because it was a really important first principle in guiding us. For Erskine Bowles and for Alan Simpson, the co-chairs of the Debt Commission, taking care of the most disadvantaged, of the most vulnerable, was at the very top of our list. Erskine said it at the start of every meeting. He said it in every public appearance that we didn't want to harm folks who had nothing to do with getting us into this crisis in the first place, and that the debate that we're trying to have isn't about sacrifice for its own sake. It's about finding a way to expand opportunity for everybody and expand access to the American dream. So we worked very, very hard to spare the poor as best we could from the budget acts, as you put it. We on Social Security, we actually put in measures that will reduce poverty. We added a special minimum benefit, 125% of poverty. We put in a bump up in benefits for those who in their 80s. Because people are living longer now, they're outliving their retirement savings, and so we need to do a lot more for the very poor and the very old. We also, at the same time, we proposed raising the retirement age very gradually. We proposed a hardship exemption for those who can't work, we did our best to spare most means-tested programs. And on the tax side, we put forward a tax reform plan that had enormous appeal to both Republicans and Democrats alike, that lowered rates, broadened the base, reduced the deficit, and was dramatically more progressive than current policy. We were very careful to watch our distributional analyses to make sure that that they were better than the way things are now. We actually reduced taxes slightly for those in the bottom quintile. And most of the other debt reduction plans out there don't do that. Domenici Rivlin relies heavily on a VAT, for example. There are arguments for that, but it falls heavily on the poor and near poor. And I think any attempt to tackle this problem is going to have to involve shared sacrifice, and it's important to focus that on those who can afford it. So, in Social Security, we asked more of those who can afford it. In tax reform, we focused on getting rid of tax expenditures, which are wildly regressive. Most of the benefit goes to upper income. The 400 wealthiest Americans pay an effective tax rate of less than 17%. A tax system that that benefits those who can take advantage of deductions and loopholes is a bad deal. It's a bad deal for working people. It's a bad deal for the poor and near poor. And then we tried to cut spending gradually, fairly, and significantly. Much of the real problem when Congress goes about cutting spending is that is if they start to take things off the table in ways that put more and more pressure on the most vulnerable programs. So, for example, House Republicans have long advocated a deep cut in discretionary spending, but said, let's let defense spending continue to grow. Our attitude, which we got bipartisan support for, was it's fine to cut spending, but if we're going to do it, let's cut everything. Let's put everything on the table so that the burden doesn't fall entirely on a handful of programs, and let's also look for ways to not just cut, but make sensible decisions on long-term investments that'll make us a stronger country over the long haul and promote economic growth. I would say, as just one last point, from the standpoint of the poor, the near poor, the middle class, and the country, doing nothing is the cruelest thing that we could possibly do. Any modest sacrifice that we don't make today is robbing opportunity from the next generation. We have to shepherd our resources now if we're going to be able to afford the kinds of programs that we want to have down the road. Those of us who are concerned about fighting poverty need to lead the charge in making government more efficient, making every program work, because the efficiency is coming. There's going to be a relentless effort to make sure that every dime we spend is well spent and produces results. And so we shouldn't be up on the Hill advocating, defending, dozens and dozens of duplicative programs. We should be the ones who are saying, give us one program that works. And I think that that's, again, a good debate for the country to have. I think the other aspect of this is we shouldn't assume that defending the status quo is a great thing. It's not as though the status quo is in American life is a terrific bargain for the poor, the near poor, the middle class. There are all kinds of things that we could do better as a nation to make sure that the money we spend is better targeted, the taxes we raise are done in a more progressive and efficient way that allows for more economic growth that will benefit everyone. There's a lot of things about the way this town works that don't produce the best result for anybody. So it's a hard debate, and we should absolutely make sure that we protect those who need it the most. But we shouldn't be afraid of this debate. This is an opportunity to reexamine fundamental aspects of the social safety net in a way that will make it stronger, that we are going to need going forward into a very competitive, tough century when we're getting older and we have more needs to meet. So I think I've been encouraged by the reaction to our plan. We knew it was a suicide mission. We're still standing a month later. And I think the tectonic plates on this issue are shifting, that a lot of the nonsense that the political system has been able to get away with is going to be harder and harder to do as time goes forward. And that gives us an opportunity to make gains on this issue that we never had a chance to make before. So thank you very much.